rubbing against the trunks, and by tomahawks. At the end of the second day, two men from the reconnaissance party would march back down the mountain to inform the main party whether to come right on or to give the scouts more time to locate the trail. If the trail could be found, Lewis was confident he could get through, because the snow was firm. So the horses got good footing without having to step over or around fallen timber every few yards. If the trail could not be found, Lewis proposed to move far to the south in search of an alternate route over the Bitterroots. On June 21st, the party fell back to the Quamash Flats, where the hunting was better. During the march, two young Indians, probably teenage boys, were encountered. They informed the captains that they were headed up the mountain to visit their friends on the other side. Lewis's eyes lit up at this news, but without Driar, he found it difficult to understand the flashing hands of the warriors. Apparently, the Indians were saying that Driar and Shannon would not be returning for two more days, but Lewis could not make out a reason for the delay. Lewis pressed the Indians to stay with his party until Driar and Shannon returned, and then to serve as guides for the crossing. They agreed to delay 2 days, no longer, at their own camp, closer to the mountains. 2 days later, still no sign of Driar and Shannon. Lewis was fearful that the two young Indians would set off that morning, so he sent four men to detain them with Sergeant Gass in command. If the Indians insisted on going, Gass and his squad should accompany the Indians to Traveler's Rest, blazing the trees as they proceeded along the Lolo Trail. That afternoon, to the relief of all, Driar and Shannon returned. The delay had been caused by bargaining, but it was well worth the time. They had with them three guides. One was a brother of Cutnose, and the other two were men who had each given the captains a horse. Lewis described them as all young men of good character and much respected by their nation. He was overjoyed to have them, even at the price of two rifles. In the morning, the expedition was off at first light. The party made it back to the campsite of June 19th to 20th, where it met with Gass, his squad, and the two Indians. The grass was good. After dark, the Indians set some fir trees on fire, telling Lewis it was to bring fair weather for our journey. This made a spectacular sight. "They have a great number of dry limbs near their bodies," Lewis explained, "which when set on fire creates a very sudden and immense blaze from bottom to top. They are a beautiful object in this situation at night. This exhibition reminded me of a display of fireworks." They were off at 6 o'clock a.m. In mid-morning, they got to the deposit they had left 9 days earlier. Everything was in good order. The snow had subsided from 11 feet to 7. As some men rearranged baggage, others cooked a meal of boiled venison. The Indians urged haste. They said it was a considerable distance to the place they had to reach before dark, the only spot where there was grass for the horses. In 2 hours, everything was ready. "We set out," Lewis wrote, "with our guides who led us over and along the steep sides of tremendous mountains entirely covered with snow. We ascended and descended several lofty and steep heights. Late in the evening, much to the satisfaction of ourselves and the comfort of our horses, we arrived at the desired spot and encamped on the steep side of a mountain convenient to a good spring. Here we found an abundance of fine grass for our horses." They had reached the untimbered south side of Bald Mountain. The grass was 10 days old, lush and green. The next grass, according to the Indians, was a day and a half's march away. On June 27th, another early start. After 8 miles, the guides reached an elevated point where there was a conic mound of stones 8 feet high. The Indians stopped for a ceremonial smoke. "From this place, we had an extensive view of these stupendous mountains," Lewis wrote. The sight filled him with awe, dread, and an even greater respect for the Indian guides. "We were entirely surrounded by those mountains," he commented, "from which, to one unacquainted with them, it would have seemed impossible ever to have escaped. In short, without the assistance of our guides, I doubt much whether we who had once passed them could find our way to Traveler's Rest." The marked trees on which he had counted so heavily when he thought the party would have to go without guides turned out to be very few and far between. but he had confidence in the guides. "These fellows are most admirable pilots," he explained. Whenever the snow was melted away, the party found themselves on the trail. After smoking with the Indians and contemplating this scene sufficient to have damped the spirits of any except such hardy travelers as we have become, we continued our march. That day they made 28 miles and camped on the side of Spring Mountain. At Bald Mountain they had been at 6,000 feet. At Spring Mountain they were 500 feet higher. There was no grass for the horses, and the men had exhausted the meat supply. The captains distributed a pint of bear oil to go into each of the 4 kettles, there to be mixed with boiled roots. Lewis judged it an agreeable dish. In the morning, Lewis cast his eye over the herd and was disturbed to see the horses looking extremely gaunt. The guides reassured him. They would be at good grass by noon. Sure enough, after 13 miles at 11 o'clock a.m., we arrived at an untimbered side of a mountain with a southern aspect. Here we found an abundance of grass. As the horses grazed, Lewis asked the guides how far to the next grass. "Farther than the party could march in the afternoon," the Indians replied. As our horses were very hungry and much fatigued, Lewis decided to make camp right there. In the morning, after a march of 5 miles took them to Rocky Point, the guides led the party down the mountain to the Lhoxa River, then up the trail to the Quamash Flats, today's Packer Meadows, a couple of miles south of Lolo Pass, on the divide between the Clearwater and the Bitterroot Rivers. They were at 5,200 feet, and there was plenty of grass. The horses grazed, and the men ate. There was still plenty of daylight left, so after dinner, the party set off down the valley toward the Bitterroot River. At 7 miles, the men reached today's Lolo Hot Springs and went into camp. As soon as camp was set up, the men, red and white, plunged into the pools created by the Nez Perce over the decades by the use of rocks. The Indians would stay in the hot bath as long as they could stand it, then leap out and run to the creek, which was ice cold, and jump in, whooping and hollering and splashing. When they were too cold, they ran back to the hot bath. Lewis took a hot bath only. He stayed in 19 minutes. It was only with difficulty that he could remain that long. It caused a profuse sweat. On June 30th, the party marched down the valley. The men were well out of the snow, but the trail was often difficult, sometimes dangerous. At one steep hillside, Lewis's horse slipped, with both his hinder feet out of the road, and fell. Lewis fell off backward and slid 40 feet before he could grab a branch to stop himself. "The horse was near falling on me as he slid," he wrote, "but fortunately recovers and we both escaped unhurt." Just before sunset, the party rode into Traveler's Rest. They had covered 156 miles in 6 days. The previous fall, the expedition had been slowed by old Toby's losing the way and by the fallen timber, and it had taken 11 days to cover the distance. On this crossing, the horses had grass every day but one. To Lewis's delight, they had stood the journey surprisingly well. Most of them were in fine order, and only want a few days' rest to restore them perfectly. This was thanks to the skill of the guides. Their sense of distance and timing, not to mention their sense of direction and ability to follow a trail buried under 10 feet of snow, was a superb feat of woodsmanship. Most of the trail was in dense forest, and the guides were young men, not yet 20 years of age. The expedition had been as lucky in its guides as Lewis had been in his fall from the horse, as Lewis knew. When he wrote that not even Driard could find his way in these mountains, he was giving his guides an extraordinary compliment. The party stayed at Traveler's Rest for 3 days. The captains put the final details into the plan for exploration they had been discussing through the winter at Fort Clatsop. In its final version, the plan went like this. Lewis, with 9 men and 17 horses, would follow the Nez Perce route to the falls of the Missouri. At the falls, he would drop off 3 men to dig up the cache and prepare to help in a portage. With the remaining 6 volunteers, Lewis would ascend the Marias, with a view to explore the country and ascertain whether any branch of that river lies as far north as latitude 50. He also hoped to meet with the Blackfeet so that he could deliver his peace and trade speech. Those missions completed, he would go to the mouth of the Marias to meet the men coming down the Missouri. Those men would be led by Sergeant Ordway. He was to proceed with Captain Clark to the head of the Jefferson River, where the expedition had left its canoes before crossing Lemhi Pass with the Shoshones. Ordway and a party of 10 men would descend the Jefferson and the Missouri in the canoes. They would get help in the portage around the falls from the 3 men left there by Lewis. Once around the falls, the combined force of 14 would proceed to the mouth of the Marias, there to pick up Lewis and his party. Reunited, they would descend to the mouth of the Yellowstone, where they would meet Clark and his group. Clark's independent exploration would start at the Three Forks. After dispatching Sergeant Ordway's party, Clark and the remaining 10 men, and Sacagawea and her boy, would cross the divide between the Missouri and the Yellowstone. When they reached the river, they would build canoes. Clark and 5 of the men, plus Charbonneau and his family, plus York, would descend the Yellowstone in the canoes to its junction with the Missouri, where almost the entire expedition would come together again. Missing would be Sergeant Pryor and 2 privates. They were assigned an independent mission. When Clark set off in the canoes, they were to take the horses to the Mandan villages to use as gifts, with strings attached, for the Mandans. They had a second charge, to deliver a letter from Lewis to the Northwest Company agent Hugh Heaney, whether at the Mandans or, if necessary, at Heaney's post in Canada. It was a highly ambitious plan, exceedingly complex, full of promise about what could be learned, dependent on tight timing. It certainly showed how confident the captains were about their men. For the first time, they were dividing the party to pursue different missions. They were giving large responsibilities to sergeants and privates, counting on their men to be able to handle independent operations without a hitch. It was also an excessively dangerous plan. The captains were taking chances they should have avoided. In the heart of the country that the war parties of Crows, Blackfeet, Hidatsas, and other tribes passed through regularly, the captains were dividing their platoon into 5 squads, so widely separated they were not in supporting distance of one another. Lewis took the risk of dividing his command because he wanted the expedition to be as successful as possible, to bring back as much information as possible, to make every conceivable effort to broker peace among the tribes, to begin the process of creating the American trading empire. These were important objectives, but not important enough to justify having squads as small as 3 men, and none larger than 10, roving about independently. The captains were underestimating the Indians. They had perhaps spent too long with the easily dominated Clatsops and Chinooks, too long with the always friendly Nez Perce. Although they knew more about the native peoples west of the Mississippi River than any man alive, they had no direct knowledge of the Blackfeet. They did know that all the other Indians feared the Blackfeet. Lewis and Clark didn't know enough to fear the Blackfeet, nor did the men. Since Lewis was leading his squad to the heart of Blackfoot country, his was the most dangerous mission. Nevertheless, when he called for volunteers on July 1st, many turned out, from whom I selected Driard, the 2 Fieldses, Werner, Frazier, and Sergeant Gass. That afternoon, Lewis wrote a 1,500-word letter to Heaney to be carried to him by Sergeant Pryor. It represented his first step toward bringing about an American trade empire stretching from St. Louis to the mouth of the Columbia. Lewis had met Heaney the previous winter and had been impressed by him, despite his being an agent for the Northwest Company. Heaney had told Lewis that if there was anything he could do for the Americans, he was ready to do it. Apparently, he talked as if he was ready to drop his Northwest Company connection and go to work for the Americans. Lewis must have thought so, for he made Heaney an offer to do just that. If Heaney could convince the influential chiefs of the Sioux to visit their new father in Washington and go along with them to serve as interpreter, Lewis would pay him $1 a day from the date of the receipt of the letter, plus expenses. Lewis further promised that Heaney would be first in line for the post of U.S. agent to the Sioux, which paid $75 per month plus 6 rations per day. Lewis was straightforward about his motives. He wanted the Sioux to have an ample view of our population and resources, and on their return convince their nations of the futility of an attempt to oppose the will of our government. Lewis provided Heaney with arguments to convince the Sioux to make the journey, the chief being that the Sioux had no means of resisting the American plans for building posts and fortifications along the Missouri, and in any case, their acquiescence will be productive of greater advantages than their most sanguine hopes could lead them to expect from opposition. Lewis stressed a central point for Heney to pass on to the Sioux. The United States will not long suffer her citizens to be deprived of the free navigation of the Missouri by a few comparatively feeble bands of savages. But he should also tell the Sioux about the friendly views of the United States government toward them and the plan to establish trading posts in their neighborhood. Through Heney, Lewis was trying to talk to the Sioux and the British. He told Heney that the Corps of Discovery had gone to the Pacific Ocean by way of the Missouri and Columbia Rivers, and that he was about to explore the Marias. He obviously hoped that Heney would pass this information on to his superiors in the company, who would inform government officials in Montreal, who would thus learn of Lewis's explorations and the potential American claim on the Oregon country, and possibly on southern Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. Lewis said he hoped to arrive at the Mandan villages about the beginning of September. Heney should meet him there with a party not to exceed 12 persons, the largest that the expedition could accommodate. A good idea. If it worked, Sioux chiefs would go to Washington, they would be mightily impressed, they would come home and make peace, renounce their British loyalties, welcome American trading posts on the Missouri, and become full-fledged partners in the grand enterprise of building the American empire. If it worked, and if Lewis found a Blackfoot band and spread the good news of the coming of the Americans and persuaded the Blackfeet to join the enterprise, within a couple of years the Americans would take over the fur trade from the Mississippi to the mouth of the Columbia. That was a big dream, an empire builder's dream. Lewis was thinking on a worldwide scale. He was proposing to set up and execute one of the biggest business takeover deals of the century and add the Northwestern Empire to the United States in the bargain. Sitting beside Lolo Creek, near the place where it flows into the Bitterroot River, in a wide, beautiful, extensive valley, at least 1,000 miles from the nearest white outpost, in command of a platoon-sized force in a country teeming with war parties, utterly destitute of equipment, except for rifles and kettles and a few remaining knives, exactly the manufactured items the Indians most wanted, Meriwether Lewis got started on making his dream come true in his letter to Heney. What a many-faceted man was Lewis. On the day he put the final touches to the plan for separate explorations, informed the men of what he and Clark intended, picked the volunteers to accompany him, and wrote that long letter to Heney, he also found time to do a bird count and write a 500-word essay on the prairie dog. The next day, July 2nd, he spent much of his time in conversation with the Indians, using sign language, trying to get a better fix on the lay of the land ahead. In the evening, "The Indians run their horses, and we had several foot races between the natives and our party with various success." He concluded with a handsome tribute to the 5 young Indians who had guided him over the Lolo Trail and thus saved the expedition. "These are a race of hardy, strong, athletic, active men." Chapter 29. The Marias Exploration. July 3rd to July 28th, 1806. On the morning of July 3rd, Lewis wrote, "I took leave of my worthy friend and companion Captain Clark and the party that accompanied him." As the captains and men shook hands and said their goodbyes, there must have been a question in every man's mind. "I wonder if I'll ever see you again." The proposed rendezvous at the Missouri-Yellowstone Junction was a full 500 miles east of Traveler's Rest as the crow flies. Clark's proposed route would cover nearly 1,000 miles, Lewis's nearly 800. Both captains would be in country they had not seen before, facing they knew not what dangers from the weather, the terrain, and the natives. Except for their rifles, scientific instruments, and journals, the men were no better equipped than the Indians, and none of the 5 detachments of the Corps of Discovery would have enough firepower to drive off a determined attack from even a moderate-sized war party. But such confident travelers had the captains become that what they said to each other as they parted was, "See you at the junction in 5 or 6 weeks." Whether their confidence in themselves and their men had swelled past all reason was theirs to discover, That Lewis felt at least a tinge of apprehension is clear from his comment on the parting. I could not avoid feeling much concern on this occasion, although I hoped this separation was only momentary. Lewis, 9 men, 5 Nez Perce guides, and 17 horses set out northward down the Bitterroot River. At 10 miles, they crossed the river by raft and continued their march eastward along today's Clark Fork River to within a couple of miles of today's Missoula, Montana. At sunset, they made camp. Hunters brought in 3 deer, which Lewis split with the Indians. He tried to persuade them to stay with his party until they got over the Continental Divide and down to the falls of the Missouri, but they said he didn't need them. The road was such a well-beaten track, even a white man couldn't miss the way. Besides, they were afraid of meeting with a Hidatsa raiding party. Just before lying down on his elk skin, Lewis ordered the hunters to turn out early in the morning to kill some meat for the guides, whom I was unwilling to leave without giving them a good supply of provisions after their having been so obliging as to conduct us through those tremendous mountains. They parted at noon the following day, July 4th. Independence Day drew no comment from Lewis, no mention of the men firing their rifles. If anything, it was a sad day, the last contact with the Nez Perce, among whom the party had been living for 2 months. The Nez Perce had seen the white soldiers hungry and fed them, seen them cold and provided fuel, seen them without horses and put them on mounts, seen them confused and provided good advice, seen them make fools of themselves trying to cross mountains 10 feet deep in snow and not snickered, seen them lost.